Welcome to the Wackle Gather podcast. My name is Judy Mitchum. Wackle is an organization for top female leaders in marketing, media, and communications. In this podcast series, I will be talking to some top female leaders, women who are also known to be change makers. This podcast is being released in advance of the Wackle Gather event on the 23rd of May. It is sponsored by Whaler, the most creative influencer marketing company. My guest today is Dame Carolyn McCall, CEO of ITV. Carolyn is one of the most admired and impressive leaders in the UK. She is one of just five female CEOs within the FTSE 100. Carolyn distinguished herself at The Guardian, starting in advertising sales and moving up the ladder to become the chief executive of The Guardian Media Group PLC. She then spent 7 years as the CEO of EasyJet, leading the company through an astonishing period of innovation, success, and growth. In this time, Carolyn was awarded a Damehood for services to aviation. She also has an OBE for services to women and a string of other accolades. A brilliant businesswoman, Carolyn also has that magic and warmth that brings people together. And I know that because I worked with Carolyn many years ago. Welcome, Carolyn.
Thank you, Judy.
So exciting to be here in ITV. I've been watching this morning in reception.
Good. Brilliant. I hope you're also watching The Bay, which is extremely exciting.
I must.
On Wednesday nights.
I must do that. So, Carolyn, starting at the beginning, you were actually born in Bangalore.
I was, and I actually lived there for many years, and my parents lived there, obviously, and I guess we were there for 18 years, and I had other links. My grandparents still lived there, and actually my grandmother died there, and I was 15 by that time. So, you know, very good links with India. I did go to boarding school at quite a young age.
I'm intrigued because I work in education, so I'd love to know.
Well, I was an only child, and my mum and dad, much as it hurt them, I think, to get me to boarding school. They did send me to boarding school. I went to an Irish convent. And I do really remember I was with a couple of girls that my parents knew the family of. And I really enjoyed it for the first 5 days. I thought it was so exciting. And then on the fifth day, I went up to one of the older girls and I said, "Can I go home now, please? It's been fun." And she said, no, "You've got a few more weeks before you see your mum and dad." And I was really upset. I didn't really understand what was quite going on. But I really enjoyed my years in India. I mean, I had a fantastic time, and I actually loved boarding school because I was an only child, and it gave me, you know, a huge, it gave me independence of spirit, and it gave me a lot of social connectivity that I wouldn't have had. And it never made me any less close to my parents. I mean, my abiding memories of my childhood are actually of being with my mum and dad, and you know, and travelling with them, and being very lucky to be able to travel all over the place. And I didn't come from a privileged background. My mum and dad made all their own money themselves. My dad was an engineer, and he just, you know, worked really, really hard to get where he was. My mum ended up working as a secretary, and she was brought up by a single mother. And in those days, that was really, really hard because her father, she never knew her father. He died in the war. So actually, you know, everyone thinks as soon as they hear an international background, they think, oh, you've been
very
born.
Glamorous.
Privileged as jets. It was not like that at all. It was a very simple childhood, actually.
And the boarding school, I'm intrigued to know because I work in education. It was a girls only boarding school in Derbyshire.
It was in India first, and then I went to the sister school in Derbyshire, Presentation Convent it was called. And I had a little aberration at the international school in Singapore where I had to do my GCSEs because I had high GCSEs. And my parents very quickly decided I was going back to boarding school because I enjoyed it far too much, being at an international school, far too many parties. So off I went back to Derby. I was sent to boarding school again.
Did you thrive in an all-girls environment?
I did. Yeah, I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. One of my closest friends is from my Derbyshire days, from doing my A-levels.
And were you a trailblazer at school? Were you highly academic and a superstar?
No. I mean, honestly, I think I was very middle of the road. And academically, you know, I think I only really came into my own when I realised I got my GCSEs and they were good enough. And then really at A-levels, when I chose my subjects, I did politics, well, I actually did history, but it was history and current affairs. And I did English and I did French and I did really well at my A-levels. And that's when I realised I could do it.
Yeah.
And before that, I was just, I was quite happy, but I cruised along. And I think that there's a big lesson there, I think.
You know,
I say this
is.
To my daughter all the time, which is just because people expect you to tick these milestones in this particular way in school.
Yeah.
And you, if you don't tick those milestones, especially if you're in an academic environment, it doesn't mean it's about you. The milestones might be wrong.
Yeah.
And I think that's really, really important. And I didn't get much pressure. I mean, no, my parents didn't put me under pressure. They just wanted me to be quiet. They wanted me to be happy.
Yeah.
And I think that's also very important for me. I don't like putting my kids into a kind of pressure cooking environment. Yeah. I mean, I nag my oldest son and it drives him completely mad. And actually, it's counterproductive, I've realised. It's taken me far too long to realise that.
Because they have to learn self-motivation.
Well, he has to learn to do it for himself. Yeah. But I have, you know, I'm better now, but I still lapse into it.
It's very refreshing to hear, though, that, you know, you're at the top of business and yet, you know, you didn't just sort of have a straightforward career where you were a trailblazer from the beginning academically, that you are actually, you know, like the rest of us.
I think, yeah, I mean, I think really I chose my degree really well. I loved my, you know, I did history and politics. I absolutely loved it. And I became an achiever academically because I loved what I was doing.
Yeah, you followed your passion.
To do more, and I pushed myself to learn more and to, you know, and then I did my master's in politics. I could have stayed, actually. I could have done a PhD. I would have kept going.
You loved it.
Yeah. My husband just said to me, well, he's now my husband. He said to me then, yeah, how long more are you going to be studying? You know? He said, don't you want to work? I thought maybe I should go to work and come back and do a PhD. You know, I loved learning, but particularly learning about politics and history, current affairs, the world today, and how it was informed by the past. I found my passion, really.
Your first job was a teacher.
Yeah.
I'm intrigued to hear.
Yeah. Yeah, it was funny. I mean, I used to...
I bet you were a great teacher.
Well, I don't know. I used to teach at Holland Park Mixed Comprehensive. And, I was brand new and I learnt a lot from the teachers there. But, you know, walking into a class, you didn't dress up to go as a teacher. You kind of wore the same clothes, you know, like casual clothes in that environment, even then. And they used to, you know, I used to have to teach them the Russian Revolution before they were doing football. Or, you know, netball or whatever it was. And honestly, trying to keep their attention taught me an awful lot.
Yeah.
Because you had to make the content really, really engaging. Yeah. You had to get them involved in it. Otherwise, there'd be a riot. I mean, I'm not, you know, there would be really quite a lot of trouble in the class.
Yeah.
So it was a great skill and I did love it.
And why did you leave?
Because they were amalgamating schools in Ilia at the time, and they were laying off a lot of the best teachers, and they were offering people like me who knew nothing really about teaching jobs, and I just really didn't agree with that.
Yes. So cut to The Guardian, where you and I worked together many years ago, and you were a complete trailblazer at The Guardian, I remember. You stayed there for 24 years.
I did.
Amazing.
But I think that's because... That was the first job. I started in research and it was my first proper job.
Yeah.
And because all the jobs I'd done before, it felt like I was just experimenting to see what and when I got to The Guardian, I realised that is where I wanted to be because I loved the culture. I liked what it stood for, independent journalism. The journalists could say what they wanted and they were not... You know, there was no proprietor.
Yeah.
It was owned by a trust. And it was, and the people were brilliant. And I was lucky because I got to do lots of different jobs. I did sales, I did marketing, I did research is where I started. I launched Guardian Unlimited, as it was called then, guardian.co.uk. I was able to launch Wired magazine in the UK
because we
did a joint venture. So I was able to do these multiple things
that
really, you know, really kind of taught me a lot.
And it was such an exciting time.
Yeah, and the people were really, and we had a great team of people across editorial and commercial, and we worked really well together. It was very invigorating.
Yeah.
And regardless of, you know, even the challenges, even later on, you know, when we launched the Berliner, and despite the fact that The Guardian is now tabloid, for its time, the Berliner did what it was supposed to do, which was it was distinctive, it was modern, it branded The Guardian, it took the brand forward and retained its kind of distinctiveness. And it was very editorially led, that decision.
Yes.
And I think that is The Guardian. And you have to understand as a commercial head how to work with highly creative and an organisation which actually puts editorial, so journalism first.
Yeah,
So that's also was great.
A very pioneering very time. And I always remember you there, as well as being a great leader, you were also great fun. And that's why I say that thing about you bringing people together. We did have lots of fun.
Yeah, we had a great atmosphere. And then, you know, I took the step up to GMG, to the Guardian Media Group, which was 8 companies, including regional newspapers and Auto Trader and EMET Business to Business. So a really eclectic mix. But because I understood The Guardian, I knew that all those businesses were really about funding The Guardian. So you had to maximize the amount of money you could make out of all of those businesses. So it was very good for me again, because I don't think I would have got the EasyJet job had I not done the GMG CEO job, because it was so different.
So let's talk about the EasyJet job. It was a very a complete change of career in terms of moving from The Guardian to aviation. What was it that lured you to EasyJet?
Well, look, the thing is, the Guardian Media Group gave me the kind of M&A experience, the kind of working on, corporate business. Running The Guardian, The Observer was very media. Mm. Running The Guardian Media Group was very much more about the businesses. And about, you know, I worked with private equity, sold a couple of businesses, got a lot of money for them, did joint ventures with private capital. All of that was really useful. So I had a very good grounding, because of my 4 years as GMG CEO, in business, which I think, you know, I had a lot of the ingredients before but I didn't have it all in one place, if that makes sense. And the thing that I felt about EasyJet was I'd been a passenger anyway. So I knew it from a customer perspective. But I asked to see the ops director as part of the process, and I knew it had to be something quite different to move from the Guardian. And they were baffled by asking to see the ops director. And I wanted to see the ops director because I knew I'd get at least some flavour for what was really
wrong.
What the real issues were. And he said to me, we've lost our passengers. We've let them down. Our punctuality is worse than Zimbabwe. Really, literally it was.
Yeah.
45% of planes were going on time. You know, it should be 80, 85%. Two, we've lost our, people who work here because we've treated them really badly. And he said, I've colluded in that. And thirdly, there's no team.
Right.
Everyone is just an individual doing their own thing.
Right.
So I walked out and I thought, well, that wasn't about aircraft. It wasn't about engines. It wasn't about, you know, being a pilot. It was about changing EasyJet as a customer business, because it wasn't thinking about customers. It was thinking about logistics. And it was about getting a team spirit and culture that was both customer facing, but also treated people with respect for what they did. And it was about building a senior leadership team which could forge forward and be aligned.
And
so I thought, well, I can do that.
Yeah, well, that
I
is your skill set.
I didn't realise how bad the operation was when I got in there. So it was very good for me, because I got very, very stuck in operationally, and I learnt more than I've ever learnt in my first year.
It's quite exciting moving from one industry and learning another. I've just done that myself by moving into education. But your fresh perspective of being a customer of EasyJet must have added a lot of value.
And yes, but you felt really, really strange saying things like that in the first few months, you know, even as a CEO.
Yes.
You know, I started daily ops meetings when I was there, because the operation was not, it was not doing well. And I put in a new ops director, and he was very good. And he also, you know, I got a top team that believed in the customer, but it took me a year to get the top team fully in place.
Right.
And in that year, I felt like a lone voice, really, saying to people, but what about the customer? They tell me about the planes. They knew exactly what was going on with the planes. And they say, we've had to cancel, you know, X number of routes, and we've had to cancel this. So this number of planes are grounded, blah, blah, blah. I say, how many passengers is that?
Uh-huh.
And they'd think, oh, passengers.
They'd people.
Add it all up. So, you know, getting that customer mentality in is actually really hard.
Yeah.
Because it's not just about people saying, I believe in it. It's about changing policies and processes to support the cultural change.
Of course, in your time there, the share price quadrupled, and you then had the highest ever passenger numbers. So quite a success. How do you manage change? What is your leadership style? I know you can be tough and fun at the same time, but what is the magic ingredients that allows you to manage such great change?
Well, I think the thing you learn really early on is that if you don't bring people with you, uh-huh. and they're not part of shaping the change, you fail.
Right.
At change, you fail. Because you can understand what's going on in the macro environment and what you think needs to be done from a strategic point of view. But, you know, people on the ground doing the work
yeah.
are not always thinking about the strategy. They're thinking about their day jobs.
Yeah.
And then they're thinking, how does that affect me?
Mm.
What am I, you know, what does that mean my job is threatened or yeah. does that mean my job is more important? So unless you get them involved in creating the change and understanding why you're changing the macro environment or, you know, whatever it might be, structural change, cyclical change, whatever it is, if they get it, they then back you all the way
yeah.
and then they become part of the change.
Yeah.
And I think many organisations that I've even seen at firsthand don't get that right early enough.
So they just make the decisions.
They make a decision at a very senior level. They don't consult. They don't take views. They don't listen. And then they kind of go, well, it's not working.
Mm.
Because actually, you need all the people in a company to make the change happen.
You pioneered an initiative about attracting female pilots, mm-hmm. Which was fantastic. Can you tell us a bit about that and how you went about it?
Well, I mean, we were just... My director of comms and I were talking about it, and we were saying we're never going to shift the gen. And we were talking about the gender pay gap before yeah. it became, you know, common currency, if you like.
Yeah.
And in 2010 and 2011, we had far too many problems to solve in yeah. terms of the operation and then getting the strategy implemented. We had to fix the operation first. So really, it was in 2012 we started really talking about it. And the key for us was we had to get more female pilots because mm. you were never going to change. You're never going to shift anything on gender
mm.
if you didn't attract more female pilots. And that happens right from school.
Yeah.
You know, I do a lot of speeches in schools. I used to go to all the Luton schools.
Yeah.
And honestly, I could not believe they would come up to me afterwards and say, I'm really good at maths. Can I apply to be a cabin crew?
You're right.
And I'd say, you're really good at maths. You can apply to do anything in this airline. And you don't even have to be really good at maths, did you know, I would say, to be a pilot. You don't have to be brilliant at maths. You know, you have to have lots of other things. You know, spatial awareness is important, but there are lots of other things that count towards being a pilot. So just changing those preconceptions, because all of those girls actually would say, my uncle is a pilot or my granddad was a pilot in the military or whatever, but they didn't have any female role models being pilots. So they didn't even consider it. So that is kind of where we started saying, well, we've got to work much, much harder to get women in. And we started doing things in flight schools because that's where... But then we started just doing things generally much more in schools about the issue. And then we started getting our female pilots to go out and talk to schools.
Yes.
And we started getting our female pilots to do lots of other publicity to say to girls
yeah.
and to teenagers and to people in colleges,
this
you're
is
welcome.
Open to you.
Come and find out more. Come and apply. Come and hear. And then, of course, you have to do some work on subsidising or helping with the cost,
yeah,
because it's very, very, it is an expensive training program.
Yes. That's an amazing initiative. You're now at ITV, and
yeah.
What an amazing office. First time I've been here.
It's not really, I'm not in an office, I'm an open plan.
Oh, well,
open
plan.
It's fantastic.
I meant the building. Yes.
Yeah, no, it's a great building. It is a great building.
We're living in this world of rapid technological change, and ITV must be at the forefront of it. I mean, how do you keep ahead and abreast of all this incredible change that's happening?
But I think the most important thing is to keep close to the viewers and who become customers. You know, so
yes.
being very, very, I really think understanding
yeah.
what they're thinking and how they're thinking about their viewing and their viewing
yeah.
habits. So one thing we know is they love our content, but increasingly that's going to be harder for them to find unless
yes.
we give them the opportunities to find it because of the proliferation of platforms. They don't just watch it on linear.
Yeah.
They watch it in lots of... Now, linear is still doing very well. You'd be forgiven for thinking it wasn't, but it's actually doing really well. And even 16 to 34s come into ITV2 when there is a programme that they love.
Yeah.
Love Island, Survival of the Fittest, whatever it might be, they will still come to ITV2. But the fact is you also have to make sure that you're being found by them in other
yeah.
places. So
yeah.
not just other platforms, but also multi-device and
yes.
make it very easy,
yeah.
all of those things. So it's not viewing, I don't think. Viewing is in total viewing is not the challenge for ITV, because I think our content is amazing. So investing in our content is incredibly important, and remaining kind of very relevant and doing great drama, but also doing live sport. So live audiences are very important. And I think it's actually 80% of all our audiences are live. They're watching live still today, which is really high.
Yes. I'm one of them, yeah, I have to say.
Lots of live. And of course, if you have sport and you have things like I'm a Celebrity, which is every night for a period of time, or Saturday, you know, these are shows that attract live audiences. And so that's very important.
It's a quality, yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, the shift is about how you make the money, because we're an ad-funded commercial public service broadcaster. So, you know, we do, our news is very trusted, it's impartial, et cetera, et cetera. But we have to make sure that we are thinking about other ways of making money, rather than being only dependent on advertising. And so our studios business, you know, we actually produce content for lots and lots of other people. So, you know, we sell content to the BBC. Bodyguard is a great example. Yes. Poldark is a great example. Line of Duty is a great example. Yeah. So, and we sell to Netflix. We do Queer Eye for Netflix out of the States. We do a whole load of stuff. You know, we do, so our studios division will make money out of content selling to other partners, to broadcasters or platforms. And then we're now setting up direct consumer so that consumers can subscribe with us. BritBox is the biggest example of that, where we're partnering with the BBC, where you'll be able to find anything that's ever been on BBC or ITV in one place.
So it's a very, very different business model now compared to how it was 10 years ago.
I think it is,
and yet the quality of the programming and the content has gone from strength to strength, I would say, as a viewer.
Good. Thank you.
Very much enjoyed Manhunt.
I mean, we actually increased viewing last year.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not just about share.
Yeah.
You know, we actually increased the volume of viewing.
Yes.
And I think, you know, everyone talks about 16 to 34s, and I hope a lot of people will be listening to this who are in the 16 to 25 age group.
Yes.
I think if we give them the content that is relevant to them and resonates with them, then they will view.
Yeah. Well, I shall make sure that 20,000 GDST girls tune in to our podcast on that note. In your career, you've said in the press that you've never encountered sexism, but if you did, you would not tolerate it.
Didn't really say that.
Oh, you didn't?
No, I didn't really say that. I said that I've experienced sexism and misogyny, but I've always handled it.
Oh, how do you handle it?
Well, I think firmly.
Good.
I mean, I do. I mean, I think, you know, you couldn't have come through the media world and not experienced sexism. I mean, I was, you know, just wherever you went, both from agent, I mean, you know, wherever you went, you know, there was always something.
Yeah.
But it wasn't hugely prevalent, if that makes sense. There would be
it's sort of undercurrent.
There is always an undercurrent, and I never said I haven't. Of course, I've experienced sexism and some misogyny, right? But and they're not always the same thing. But you know, I think you have to have the confidence to be firm, and I know that takes a lot. So you know, you just have to stand up for what you believe in.
Great advice.
And actually, you will get people sympathetic to you.
Yeah.
But most important is you face it if you
head on.
Now, when it's someone in a position of power over you, that has happened to me, I think you just, I just went back and said, I'm not dealing with that person again. That's, you know, that's, I'm not doing that again. And my ad manager at the time was like, what's happened? And I told him, and he believed me. And that was the end of that.
And he backed you. Fantastic.
He backed me and said, right, you don't have to do that again.
So in your career, you are very, very, you have been very high profile, you know, on the News Today programme, you know, Sky News, we've seen you perform. You are fantastic. Have you ever had any moments, funny moments that didn't go well?
Oh, gosh, many. I mean, not funny. I mean, they're not funny when you're on live TV. There's no funny moments on that. I mean, you know, you just learn from everything you do. And, you know, it's only high profile because you're doing it for your company.
Yeah.
I wouldn't do it. I mean, I really wouldn't be on all of that if I didn't have to do it. So I do it with the results.
Yeah.
Half your results, full year results, you go on. and you're representing your company. But, you know, live TV is one of those things where you can be asked anything at any time. And the Today programme is live. And you just have to, you have to be very on top of your brief. And you have to go with it. And if you make a mistake, you make a mistake.
You learn from your...
You just learn from it. Yeah. You have to learn.
So lastly, I just want to talk a little bit about Wackle Gather, which is on the 23rd of May this year, and we're counting down to Wackle Gather. I know you're sending some girls from ITV, or women from ITV, young women. Sorry, I work for the Girls Dead School Trust, so I keep using that word. Tell me what you think the value will be of Wackle Gather to them.
Yes, I loved, I love Gather. I mean, I was, we've been doing it now for quite a long time, and I was involved quite early on.
Yeah, I've seen you speak at it.
I did a keynote twice, actually, in two different worlds. I did it when I was at GMG and then again when I was at EasyJet. I think the value of it for women is they get there, they hear from senior women about how they deal with issues, crises. You know, it's very easy to look at senior women and think they're so confident. Oh my God, you know, how could we possibly be like that? That's not me. But actually, when you see the range of senior women who all share extremely openly, actually, like I have done with you today, you know, you get a very trusted environment. And it's very inspiring, I think, to say, actually, there's not one way to get what I want to do. There's many, many different ways.
Yes.
And if they can all be successful at doing this in lots of different areas, then I can do it too.
Yes.
So it's very inspirational. I think it's also practical. I love the fact that it is a very practical thing where it gives you real tips, tangible advice. You know, you leave Gather with things that you will do differently or that you will think about differently. And I love that about it. And I think the third thing is it's a fantastic network because you will click with people when you get there. There will be people that you want to see again and that you will see again if you want to.
Yeah.
So it's a great network as well.
Yes, I think you're so right. And I actually remember some of the tips you gave when you spoke at Wackle Gather several years ago. So those things sort of stay with you, which is fabulous. And my really last question is this, that you're a mum, you've got three lovely children, you've got a daughter, Emmy, I think it's her name. And, you know, what advice do you give her about her career, and are you optimistic for the future for women?
Yeah, I'm very optimistic about the future. I think things have changed. I mean, not sufficiently. I think things, you know, you said 100 CEOs. It's been like that for so long. And it would be lovely to see that change, because I think if you don't have women in senior positions, then you don't change culture. You know, culture has to continue to change, and it's got to happen more quickly.
Yeah.
It's just slow.
Yeah.
But when I look at my daughter, I see a very, she's quite feisty, but she's also quite shy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of girls, you know, can lack confidence. And I've read somewhere that, oh, it's ridiculous to talk about confidence with girls, other things. There's no question in my mind that confidence and self-esteem is extremely important to girls. It's important to boys as well, but girls manifest, I think, differently.
Yeah.
And so it is important that they believe they can do a variety of things, that they don't pigeonhole themselves, that they don't think, oh, I can't do it because I'm not very good at that, or I'm not very good at this. They need to explore opportunities and they need to be bold and brave, but they need people around them that can give them that self-esteem and confidence. And so those are the discussions I try and have with Emmy, although she doesn't always, I have to say, she doesn't listen. She gives me as much as advice as I give her, which I always think is quite funny. But it's true, she will tell me if she thinks I'm not doing something properly or I'm not kind
keeps you grounded.
Yeah, she says, there's no point talking about that. That's not relevant to me. So, you know, I think that's the best way it can be.
On that very positive and optimistic note, I want to say a very big thank you to Carolyn McCall, CEO of ITV. A thank you to Mediacom, who've helped us with the technical side, and a thank you to the team at the GDST. Don't forget to get your tickets to Wackle Gather on the 23rd of May 2019, and we look forward to seeing you there.